This is Esther Rakusin of WRFI News. Last week, I spoke with Professor Elizabeth Sanders of the Cornell University Department of Government. We talked about the reasons why Donald Trump won the election and the aftermath of the election. Here is the second part of our conversation. I'm wondering how much of the populace that voted for Trump is concerned about the fact that he did not release his tax forms when requested. He is a billionaire and has a lot of money and does not seem to follow the rules. Do you think that people who voted for him are starting to wonder how that's going to play out in the end, whether it's going to help them in the end?
I can't speak to that without looking, you know, at survey data. What I've heard when people were interviewed and what I've read in these political, anthropological, investigative reports is that people just didn't care. They thought those were just, compared to losing your job, losing your income, having your whole community dry up and blow away, as threatened so many upstate New York communities, it's just so much more important than whether he releases his tax returns. And for a long time, I think before WikiLeaks, which was not a voluntary release, one knew, you know, Hillary Clinton wasn't releasing her speeches. This was Trump's counter to that, right? You release the speeches you made to Goldman Sachs, and maybe I'll release my tax returns. I'm sure that bothered people, and yet that seems such a minor issue compared to the big ones that were wrecking your family and your community. So people just sort of dismissed it, particularly because they had two candidates, two remarkably unpopular candidates who were doing things they didn't approve of. And I think in a way, maybe they gave Trump a pass on some of this stuff because he was a businessman, and businessmen are expected to be greedy and to exploit the tax code. I mean, that's what they do, right? That's how capitalism works. But Hillary Clinton had a position of public trust, and she seemed to be using her position as Secretary of State to raise money for her foundation. In fact, the majority of people that she had meetings with that weren't directly employed by the U.S. government were people who gave big donations to the Clinton Foundation, which supported her family. So those things would just kind of balance out, I guess. Mm-hmm. And in the end, I think one mistake she made was spending way too much time talking about his totally reprehensible personality, which people had already said, yeah, I know, but that's not the main issue. Mm-hmm. And so it was just lost, and it just made her look very vitriolic and kept her from talking in a more positive way about what she was going to do and mm-hmm. convincing people that she would do things on which she had held exactly the opposite position most of her life.
Right. So I just want to switch gears a little bit. Another of your research interests is the executive branch. And one thing I've been curious about is how some of the informal rules of the branch are laid out, such as the tradition of divesting from one's own business and investments so as not to have conflicts of interest. Mm. But this is not actually a requirement as far as I've heard and read. Can you speak on this subject?
There are some requirements, though, and there is a nepotism law. And so, you know, it's a bit iffy to hire your children. I mean, we know that other presidents have done things like that. Bobby Kennedy put his brother in as head of the Justice Department, which I thought then and now is really pretty iffy. But we do have some laws about that, and they have been violated. I think, you know, Hillary Clinton and what was supposed to happen with the Clinton Foundation didn't quite happen, wasn't quite at a distance. We know now from the WikiLeaks mainly that the interest of the Clinton Foundation and the State Department and Hillary Clinton and Hillary Clinton's campaign chest were very much intermeshed. So those are not the hardest rules we have, unfortunately, and they don't. But, you know, there's so many worse ways that presidents, through their appointments, violate the public trust. And we're watching those very closely, and we have to keep watching closely as Trump does this. Trump, I think more than other presidents, is about appointing loyalists. And it's not so much big donors as it is people who supported him when most people didn't. And he's willing to appoint these people to positions even though they're not qualified. And they have opinions even that clash with his own. John Bolton as Secretary of State, it's such a crazy idea, but Bolton came out for Trump when very few other people did. Most of the neoconservatives had bailed out and were for Clinton, actually, but Bolton was there for him, and so Bolton may get to be Secretary of State. And he was a major architect of the Iraq War. And you think, what is he doing? Does he, you know, he says he was opposed to that war and thinks it was a terrible war and doesn't want to do that again. And he's going to put John Bolton into the cabinet? I mean, we'll see if he has second thoughts about that. But I think the biggest problems with appointments are presidents looking for loyalists, looking for people who will help them raise money, and so on. And that really is corrupting.
And do you feel that in this case, the executive branch, you know, President-elect Trump, appointing these different loyalists is going to rub up against Congress?
You know, that's going to be good to see. In the case of John Bolton, you have at least one Republican, he's a rather unusual one, Rand Paul, who has said that he's going to fight tooth and nail to keep Bolton out of the cabinet. That's a healthy thing, I think, if he gets opposition within his own party, because he recognizes, though, he ran against his party. With very little help from them, except at the very end. He recognizes he needs a party. That's why he had Reince Priebus as chief of staff. That was a good move. Putting Pence on there was a smart move for him, because these people have very good ties with the party. He can't pass anything in Congress without party support. He could even, if he kept up the anti-party thing, he could even be impeached by a Republican House of Representatives. That's not so wildly impossible in a year of very unusual happenings, right? So, I'm looking for pushback in the party for people to say, no, not him. But we'll see. So far, we only have one example of that.
And do you see Trump's election as changing anything in American political or social movements? Do you think that voters will start to support so-called third parties?
Right now, if the anti-establishment candidate takes over the party and changes it so that it's much more sympathetic to the interest of working class people, that doesn't help. You saw the way third parties just vanished. They just really went to nothing, which is typical in a very close race. But I don't see third party support as long as they've got some hope of controlling a major party. Most social movements would really like to take over a major party. Right? The populist went into the Democratic Party. The people supported Reagan went into the Republican Party. Trump people. A major party is just so much more potent. Our electoral system is stacked against third parties. So nobody's going to go third party if they can have a major one.
And you don't think there will be more a call for support of third parties in the future, for example, allowing them to participate in debates?
It's fine to have them around in debates, but I don't think, for example, Democrats who supported Hillary Clinton are going to be very keen on third parties, since Jill Stein and Gary Johnson could be said to have cost her the election. Their margins in a number of close states were higher than the difference between her and Trump. So I don't see who's going to be very keen on third parties right now. I think what people want to do is rebuild the Democratic Party, not a third party, not yet anyway, mm-hmm. but to try to rebuild the Democratic Party more along the vision of Bernie Sanders, to make it a real working class party, which it stopped being with mm-hmm. Bill Clinton mm-hmm. altogether. There was nowhere. I noticed at the time that Bill Clinton was the first Democratic president ever to talk about the middle class and not to mention the working class at all. Mm-hmm. I thought, that's really odd. And Bernie Sanders noticed that too, right? Mm-hmm. So if the Democratic Party could be reformed, restructured, revitalized, revisioned, there wouldn't be any need for a third party. Likewise, if the Republican Party could become very different. But, you know, people are thinking of we're thinking of lots of strange thoughts now, that there could be a realignment in which chunks of the population just flopped over the line. Mm-hmm. And you had, well, a number of people are saying there's going to be a college graduates party. The new elite party will be a Democratic Party of college graduates, well-educated people who love free trade and open borders and don't care about social programs very much. And that could, in effect, be the new Republican Party. But mm-hmm. it would be Hillary Clinton's version of the Democratic Party, which is a very elite party. Mm-hmm.
And finally, do you foresee any changes in the voting system as a result of the fact that for the second time in two decades, the Republican candidate won the electoral vote while the Democratic candidate won the popular vote?
Yeah, that's twice, and we only had four of those, and two recently. So one does wonder. There's obviously a lot of people are talking about changing the outcome of the election in two ways. One is to work on getting existing Trump electors to become what political scientists call faithless electors. In other words, they don't vote the way those who voted Republican thought they were going to vote, but they just go off on their own, kind of in the way the founding fathers envisioned they would be free agents and just vote for the best person. But we haven't done that in a long time. We've for a long time had the idea that the electors were just a kind of automatic appendage of the popular vote. I think the faithless elector gambit is not only a waste of time, but very anti-democratic, little d. I think also that amending the Constitution to get rid of the Electoral College is not going to work. And I say this as a person who's lived through four of those episodes in which, you know, we had close elections. We thought, oh, let's get rid of this crazy thing. The Electoral College just have the popular vote. But once it gets down to brass tacks in Congress and they start figuring out who'd be advantaged and who'd be disadvantaged and how it would change things, it would create a multi-party system because you'd have a runoff election, you have a two-step election. So you'd have multi-parties in which the multiple parties would be sort of like intense interest groups. You would break up any semblance of national unity that comes out of the electoral system now. You might have, you know, all the winners would be concentrated on the East Coast and the Pacific Coast and everybody in between left out, because that's where the popular vote would be concentrated. So there are a lot of, it was said by political scientists for a long time that if you did away at the Electoral College, you would diminish the role and the voice of minorities and people in cities. And of course, minorities tend to live more densely in cities. Once people start gaming out what would happen, you end up not amending the Constitution. I think if people want to put their energies into something that could be productive, it's not abolishing the Electoral College. It's abolishing Citizens United and reducing the power of money in American elections. There are all kinds of things one could do, but not those two, not the faithless elector and abolishing the Electoral College. I think, I mean, what there's going to be more attention to is reducing the vote with long lines and reducing the vote by manipulating the rules. And both parties did those, but they did different ones. So the Republicans are all into, let's have fewer voting places and fewer early voting days so we keep the people, you know, from voting who would vote for our opponents. But Hillary Clinton's people did the same thing. When independents could vote in party primaries, they made it as difficult as possible for them. And there was a lot of unhappiness among Bernie Sanders supporters, thinking that they could have won had there been a fairer vote. So I think there'll be a lot of attention to that, as there should be. Mm-hmm. I mean, if democracy is going to work, it's got to be easy to vote, not hard.
Mm-hmm. Well, Professor Sanders, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Oh, you're welcome. So much to talk about.